It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, and doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Merry Christmas. Oh, I'm sorry, it's NPR. December greetings. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which you can... What someday we'll update, but you can read it at
filmsociology.tumblr.com. I feel like that's always the New Year's resolution.
Working
our
on
New
the
Year's
blog.
Yeah, our New Year's resolution that gets abandoned maybe a
so
so a
this is
weeks in.
Film Sociology's version of losing weight and eating better.
Yeah.
The voice you just heard, back from vacation. He was visiting all the Film Sociology branches. That's Kobe Slagle.
All the franchises. Everybody's doing good.
Did everybody get their Film Sociology bonus?
Yeah. California branch is doing good. Fort Myers branch is doing good.
They either got a towel or a VCR. And joining me is to, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this show is happening on a Friday. We had contemplated recording ahead of time, and I'm glad that we did not. And it also shows us a true sign of people who love movies and friendship. I have Joe Shearer from the Film Me app over here, Ed Johnsonot from Nuvo, and Don is hanging out. How are you, gents? Thank you for coming in the day after Christmas.
That's my proud son, Donald Johnson.
Donald Johnson. So,
hi.
Hi, Joe. Hey,
so,
Matt.
Joe, what's happening at the Film Me app?
Quite a bit. Thanks for asking.
Oh!
You know, I was looking at the Film Me app recently, and I said to myself, I love this website. If only there was a fresher design, just something zippy and new for the new year. But I guess, you know, that's just too much to hope for.
But however, Film Me Up is your plate.
Nice to see you too, Ed. Merry Christmas.
He's actually lobbing a very nice softball my way because, yes, we are redesigning. That will be coming.
See, I was no chump.
Yeah. He doesn't just come out to run us down over here. We're pals. We're bros.
We're setting him up, Kobe.
These guys are also going to go shoot Kim Jong-il later.
that was Chris Paul to my Blake Griffin. So.
Oh.
You know, Kobe's negativity is just tainting the whole new year.
That's my fault. I take that problem. But remember, folks, the Film Yap is where you go. Mm-hmm. For a little of this and a little of that.
Absolutely.
And a fresh new look coming.
Yeah.
And speaking of fresh new looks, they have two front page cover stories in Nuvo this week featuring the host of Stolen Moments, Stephen Stolen. And you can check out Ed's Top 20 and Annoying Five. Although
That's
there's
right.
five of us in the studio, but we're not on that list, at least this week. So, but big Christmas week for movies. But I guess we have to be news topical. I know... Joe did as well as I. We faced international threats and the possibility of international terrorism because Indianapolis is on the main list for North Korea. But Joe and I separately saw The Interview, the latest bromance from Seth Rogen and performance artist James Franco. Am I wrong?
Is that what you call that?
He is performance artist James Franco, just like Billy Bob Thornton is always referred to as Boxcatcher's front man, yes. Bob Thornton. So you saw it at home. I actually went to Georgetown today. There were probably about 30 people in the theater, and, I made it back. Everything's fine.
Yeah.
First off, kudos to Georgetown for showing it. It's the only theater in Indy, I guess in central Indiana, showing it. Mm-hmm. And kudos for Sony for kind of... You know, getting their spine back a little, and you're able to watch it online.
Yeah.
You were able to rent it. Mm-hmm. I just wish it had been funnier.
Yeah.
You know, well, for all the hoopla about it, I wish it had been, you know, it's and I think more than one writer, one critic has referred to it as, you know, a monumental a statement on the First Amendment and mm-hmm. for free speech. Mm-hmm. It's just not that fun a movie.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I'll tell you, I enjoyed it.
It didn't really look like it would be from the trailers. But
no.
Yeah, I mean, it was, to me, it was enjoyable. It wasn't anything, you know, world-beating. And after the hype, after all of this hoopla, it's got to be just the funniest thing ever,
and
or
it's
a bust.
And it's not.
It's just not. There's a lot of, I mean, I'm just going to say, James Franco is kind of crazy, but he's not the greatest comedian in the world.
I think watching his role, he plays, of course. And by the way, they don't play each other. I was wondering if they were playing each other, like in This Is the End.
Yeah.
But he plays a talk show host, a lightweight talk show host, mm-hmm. and Seth Rogen, who actually plays the quote unquote straight person.
Yeah.
The brains of the operation as his producer, and of course they don't hit the hard news, and they find out that Kim Jong Un is a fan of this program, and that's how they get said interview. But Franco's performance, I think Cameron Diaz and Annie went, calm down.
Relax.
He's kind of all over the place. And there is that kind of Rogan-Franco bromance that is a part of that bubble of humor. That's there, but it's like he chugged Red Bull before each shot. It's exaggerated to a degree. It just separates from everything else.
Yeah, and again, problem. You know,
that's a problem.
It's, to me, the movie was at its best when... And I don't, you know, we don't want to get into too much of the detail of what happens, but at some point, Kim and James Franco's character kind of are spending some time together.
So it's a bromance triangle.
It is a
just
bromance
with one
triangle.
Of the most powerful people on the planet.
Yeah, and
Kim Jong Un.
Right?
Do they kill him?
We don't do that. We don't do that around here.
Well, I mean, you can look online.
You can look up this stuff.
Yeah, they had been playing a certain clip that was, we shall say, spoiler filled.
We don't do that here.
Yeah, we shall refrain from doing that.
Well, at least it opened this week. Ask us next week, maybe. We'll tell you.
Yeah.
And Soylent Green is people.
they were dead the whole time.
And Bruce Willis knew it. And everybody on the Orient Express killed them. So there is, as I was watching it, I thought of, because I was trying to sound academic while observing it almost felt like that Franco and Rogan wanted to make their own Hope and Crosby picture, you know, mm-hmm. The Road to North Korea, mm-hmm. or Abbott and Costello meet Kim Jong-un,
yeah.
Where it's just a couple of dopes who get into dopey situations, mm-hmm. and they want, and of course they get their own girl, which is
right.
Yeah, well done.
Various chicanery.
There is various degrees and levels of chicanery in this film, Kobe's. Thank you.
And like most Crosby and Hope films, somebody gets something put up their rear end.
Of course.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're not, and we won't give that away either. Although that's in the trailer as well.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how many more of these, because I did enjoy This Is the End. I wasn't sure how you guys were about that, but I'm wondering if this is going to start to wear thin, as far as the style of these guys working together and thinking they're kind of God's gift to comedy a little bit.
The Interview 2, The Killing of Putin.
Still interviewing.
Yeah.
Second round interviews.
Yeah. That's right. And I'm sure this is, my wife likes to use the term made by boys for boys. This is definitely up that alley. By the way, there's a party scene that's heavily edited, but in slow motion at the same time.
Yes.
In a Seth Rogen, James Franco film. I know. I'm surprised, right?
And they did my favorite shot from the trailer, which you could call, putting it delicately, a money shot. Was actually left out
Thank
of the
you.
Final movie.
Yes, that's that's quite all right. And
yes.
please say it involves cash.
It involves Franco and Rogan. It's all over the trailer, and it made me laugh the very first time I saw it. And it's not actually in the movie, but they do something of a replication of the scene involving someone else later on, but still didn't have quite the same effect.
Yeah, and as far as the representation of Kim Jong-un, I think his dad would be a little more ticked off with Team America. I'm guessing.
Yeah, very
so, much. So either his handler, either he had a better sense of humor, or he had really good handlers, mm-hmm. or he doesn't have the internet.
Right.
Did either of you see Franco and Rogan on Naked and Afraid?
No.
I'm not.
All right, I was wondering if it was funnier than that.
I don't know, so I'm going to...
No.
Not fun?
It was funny for a little bit, and then it and it parts there were laughs, but mostly it was, you know, they goof around and you just kind of watch them goof around.
That's like this film.
Seth Rogen was naked and afraid at the same time at one point of this movie.
We all are.
We were definitely at that time too.
Right. I wish it had been shorter. I wish it, and this is also one of those comedies where I'm of an age. I'm sure I would have liked it a lot more if I was 10 years younger or 20 years younger, but I'm not, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Right.
So, yeah, are we telling people to go see it, or on principle, or just be prepared to be sort of disappointed?
I would say sure. I mean, if you wanted to see it before this,
we have a new one. Sure.
If you wanted to see it before all this mess went down, go see it. If you watched the trailer or saw some spot somewhere and thought this movie is going to be terrible, then it's not going to change your mind.
And if you see an article in the Star.
Oh, yeah. Now, Ed saw something in today's Not Nouveau.
If you see an article in the Star about how the crowd was chanting USA, USA at the Georgetown, please take a look at the body of the article where you find out that the guy they were interviewing chanted USA, USA, while his wife shouted America once. And he's not sure how many other people joined in. So, in other words, he chanted USA, USA.
So two people said something, and it made the subhead of the article.
Yeah. Thank you, Star, for being the Star.
That's so Star. All right, let's move on. Let's move on to other pictures. Opening in theaters, and this is part of our marathon of press screenings.
Yeah.
Tim Burton. Okay, good news, bad news. Actually, it's good news. Tim Burton and Johnny Depp apparently took a sabbatical, so Johnny Depp could put on a costume and be freakish for another director.
No, he dressed as Christoph Waltz in this film. Didn't you realize
no.
that?
No.
It was an amazing disguise of Johnny Depp.
Well, salute to him. But yeah, it's Christoph Waltz and Amy Adams are in Tim Burton's new film called Big Eyes, based on a true story. And for once, it's actually based on a true story I sort of care about. Where
are you going to play the clip?
No, we're not going to play the clip.
I've got the clip.
Do you really? Oh, Ed has not done this in a while. So, Ed, please, give us the clip for Tim Burton's Big Eyes.
Wow, honey, it's the 50s, and you really are a beautiful woman. I'd like you to be part of my life. Oh, okay, you're an artist, too. Well, yes, I am. I'm a great artist, and I've seen the world. Oh, look at those paintings you do of the little kids with the big eyes, dear. They're really striking. Look at my landscapes, though. They're much, much better. Wow, people are buying the little kid paintings, the big eyes. I mean, some of the art people don't like them, but everyone else does. Oh, this is so wonderful. I'm glad to be getting credit for my work. Well, people wouldn't take a woman seriously, so I didn't give them credit for your work. I said I did it. You couldn't do that. But I did do that. But it's not right. But I'm doing it anyway. Oh, my God. Well, you have to keep working, too, or our family will go to jail. Oh, goodness me. What am I to do? I know. I'll become a Jehovah Witness. Oh, I could never lie now, so I've got to tell the truth. Hi, we're in court now in Hawaii. But. It's not right. I painted the paintings. I painted them.
You didn't even paint the landscapes, you... Oh, I can't...
When did Terry Jones from Monty Python star in this movie?
Here's what you have to do. Everyone, brother, you sit down and paint one of those little kid paintings.
Oh, I know what to do now.
I can't. I've got an old shoulder injury. The end.
Starring Maggie Smith and Amy Adams. Yourself, Waltz.
That's the best Amy Adams I've ever heard.
That's outstanding. That being said, Ed, what'd you think?
I had fun. I mean, you know, who wouldn't enjoy that? I mean, the trailer really gives away, you know, but I mean, who wouldn't enjoy that? It was fun. I mean, it wasn't a great, satisfying Tim Burton movie. But I mean, as far as like a lesser Ed Wood, and I loved Ed Wood.
Yes, that's still my favorite Burton film.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to see him kind of back on track after some pretty disappointing stuff. And it's really nice to see Johnny Depp not there.
Not in there. And it's the same screenwriters that he worked on with Ed Wood. I think they also did People vs. Larry Flint. And one thing I had noticed, I think I have to the credit NPR for coming up with this. I wish I had come up with it. But it was he is highlighting what is kind of kitsch, without making the artist a godlike figure or making the artist way better than they really. I mean, he loves Ed Wood. He obviously Burton enjoys these paintings, but it doesn't. He's not making a biopic as if it's the greatest contribution to mankind.
And I did a little check in. From what I can understand, now given this is based on the book written by the woman,
right?
But the movie appears to stick pretty close to the book. I think she became a Jehovah's Witness before they moved to Hawaii, and Burton seemed to just think it would be more fun to have that part of her Hawaiian transformation.
Right.
But other than that, I mean, the main thing is the paint off in the courtroom did happen.
Wow. Right, and that was kind of I was just kind of waiting for that moment, but Waltz is good. I mean, the performances are solid. It's what you would expect from Adams and from Waltz.
Yeah, I mean, Adams isn't going to win anything because I mean it's a performance that works, but a lot of people could have done it.
Yeah,
Christoph Waltz, you know, he does this Christoph Waltz thing.
I love the fact that he now has a thing because he is charming. There's an air of sophistication to him, but then as the layers of the onion unravel, there's a dark side. And
you have that thing where it's like he drank a bunch of energy drinks.
Yeah.
A little bit of that.
Yeah.
And he's the kind of guy that when he speaks, he has the smile where you know he's full of it, but you don't care. You're just like, I know that this is going to be bad, but I'm going to go along with it because you're just cool. And that's
I hope he maintains that for a while because he elevates the film. The Robert Pattinson, Reese Witherspoon elephant movie. Best thing about that picture. So, so Joe, what'd you?
I would say I enjoyed it. I believe Nick Rogers wrote the Film Yap review and he said, leave your Oscar expectations behind and just enjoy the movie. And that's what you do. It's not a world beater. It's not a big time, you know, hard hitting movie about ethics. And you know, it's very obvious. One of them is a dirtbag. One of them's kind of being taken.
And one of them is Christoph Waltz.
I don't know which one.
Yeah, and in a sense, they're both, you know, not the most upstanding people maybe in the end. But you know, there's a definite good guy and bad guy, and you know that he has to get his right, and he keeps justifying, and it's just a decent, solid movie that you go and see and have a good time with. You laugh. It's not I think Burton's influence is the lightheartedness of it, but it's not as quirky as most of his movies.
Ed, because I'm asking because you're the elder statesman of the group. Who had a better cinematic representation? San Francisco in the 60s in this film or Southern California in the 70s with Inherent Vice?
This film.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do we know when Inherent Vice is opening?
It's coming, I think, the second week of January.
So we'll talk about that.
I'm going to do that trailer.
Okay. Yeah, no, not yet. Too long, too weird.
Dude.
also opening in theaters is, I guess I'm just going down the list, but this is a film that made Ed's list, and we saw, I think this was the last thing we saw as a group, but and it's not quite tackling Gone Girl as the date film of the year, but Foxcatcher.
Oh, yeah.
The new film from Bennett Miller, who gave us Capote and Moneyball. And as I got done watching it, I realized, and this is also based on a true story, a very warped true story, of Bennett Miller seems to have not quite like David Fincher, but the film's about detail. About Capote doing writing in cold blood, you know, the travelings of the Oakland Athletics and what Billy Beane does in Moneyball. And in this one, it's the story of a true story of John DuPont, played by Steve Carell, who wants to finance the U.S. Olympic wrestling team. So he brings in brothers Mark Ruffalo and Channing Tatum, and they start working on his compound and things just get a little too uncomfortable and unsettling for words, and it leads to bad things happening at the very, very end.
Yeah. If you know the story, you know the outcome of it. I don't know how much we'll want to talk about the actual outcome.
I was concerned about seeing the film because I did know the outcome of the story from the news event. And I knew that they were going to do their best to stick to the story, which meant that we weren't going to get answers.
Yeah.
But when you get in there, the performances are so strong, and their determination to stick to the reality and not add anything makes it just fascinating. And you, I mean, Channing Tatum and Steve Carell become, they work closely together, and they have a relationship. Channing Tatum's character, you understand, basically, I think, most of us figure out what he needs in his life, mm-hmm. and what he's kind of getting from his relationship with Steve Carell. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, he needs a father figure.
Correct.
He needs a mentor. But Steve Carell's character, who was called paranoid schizophrenic, we don't know. You know, but that's, I mean, he was called and diagnosed that later. You spend the whole movie and the ride home and much time afterwards trying to figure out what in the world was going on in that man's head from moment to moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so fascinating that a movie that doesn't give that away, it leaves it to you to write the ending, and it's so compelling.
It does. We were talking last week about the film Wild, and there's a few moments in that with the Reese Witherspoon character where plot points we have seen in thousands of films are kind of dangled, and they're just kind of there hanging in front of you, and then they kind of go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's even more, I think it's even more of a gray matter with Foxcatcher. But yeah, is it, what kind of relationship is this? And it doesn't address it. And you would think, because you have, and Steve Carell has the you know, the makeup nose, and this is what people would consider. I mean, I know they're kind of pushing him heavy for Best Supporting Actor on this because it's a comic doing a dramatic role. He's altered his looks. It is completely different from anything he's ever done before. And this is also another really good use of Channing Tatum.
Okay.
I think, you know, I'm hoping he is done with the G.I. Joes and the Nicholas Sparks novels, where he's able to find films that utilize his strengths, mm-hmm. like on 21 Jump Street, like on Magic Mike, and like on this one. You know, there's a scene where the opening scene, it's funny, I had to do a speaking engagement at a middle school in Anderson, Indiana, mm-hmm. the day after seeing Foxcatcher. And the opening scene, he gets a $20 check for lecturing about being an Olympic wrestler to an audience of kids who just don't care. And it, but this is all he has in his life. This is all he wants to do. And he's got this, it turns to be an estranged relationship with Mark Ruffalo, who finds another fascinating performance.
Mm-hmm.
He finds new ways to say he's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just intriguing. And it is kind of a 2 hour and 15 minute waiting for the other shoe to drop, but it doesn't drop like you think it should.
No.
The funny thing was when the original news story of this came out, I was just completely baffled as to why this happened. And after seeing this movie where you see everything leading up to this event, you see the event, I still have no idea exactly why it happened. And that's a good thing in terms of this movie, because
it should be frustrating, but
yeah.
It's not.
No.
Yeah.
There are moments of jealousy. There, you could say there's a triangle involved, but we're not quite sure what kind of triangle or why.
Yeah. Plus, you get to see Channing Tatum in a singlet a lot.
Ed said that.
Yep.
And yeah, and it does, but it does capture that kind of the world of an amateur wrestler.
Yeah.
You know, this is all this kid wants
Olympic
to do.
Style
Olympic
wrestling.
Right. So. You know, the training, the isolation, mm-hmm. the fact that you're hanging out with all these guys, and they're all living and training and kind of almost like product, almost mm-hmm. like a pet,
yeah.
on Steve Carell's property.
And that scene with
John DuPont's property.
The scene where Channing Tatum's character is trying to make weight, and he's 12 pounds off
the
mark.
Oh, yeah, we've heard these stories. You know, it's like De Niro running in the steam box in Raging Bull. He loses
uh-huh.
12 pounds.
In a day.
The things that you do, it's almost like a whiplash. The things that an athlete will do to make weight, to mm-hmm. get rid of that whatever you need to be toned and ready to go.
Yeah, and I do want to comment on Mark Ruffalo's performance, as you already did. When I heard he was in this, I thought, why in the world is he here? And even his character, when you see he's a wrestler, an Olympic-level wrestler, which is not what you think of Mark Ruffalo at all.
I'm sorry, he's a Hulk.
Yeah,
he's half a Hulk.
He's a Hulk. And he's, you know, he's been so many other people in so many movies, but he's never been that sort of brutish, you know, rough kind of character. And he absolutely nails it.
I think, I tend to think we think of wrestlers... Mm-hmm. amateur and pro of, yes, they're really good at what they do, and not a whole lot else. My apologies to the wrestling community.
Right.
Well, and he's so good. Ruffalo is so good at being, he's together. He's the one guy in the film that's together.
Yes. Right.
You
family.
Know, unresponsible.
And
And he's a great big brother.
Yes.
Correct.
You know, and he gets all that stuff right.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny that the relationship between the brothers, he is a great big brother, and Channing Tatum's character knows that, but he still resents him.
Well, part of it is because he's such a great big brother.
Yeah, yeah.
It just makes Channing Tatum's character feel more, you know, worse about himself
because
he can't be that kind of guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is, again, not a date film, but definitely worth checking out.
Oh, absolutely.
And at least it's not bleak outside in December, end of December, but you should go see
it. It was number 8 on my best 20 movies of the year, and it would have probably been higher, you know, it would probably be higher now.
Yeah. Wow. I was about to say, has your list changed since publication?
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get to that in a little bit.
Okay.
Now, according to Nouveau, this was at print number 9 on your list, The Imitation Game.
Uh-huh.
Benedict Cumberbatch's hopefully shining moment, because nobody saw The Fifth Estate, mm-hmm. and we know him from Sherlock and everything else, where he's becoming one of the more popular, likable guys in the business. And this, as Chris Lloyd said, it's the most Oscar looking film because
Absolutely.
It's based on a true story. Mm-hmm. It's an important issue. He plays a code breaker working for the British government to try to break the Enigma code by Germany in World War II. On top of that, his especially in the second half of the film, his lifestyle comes into question.
Yes.
And what turned out to be, he couldn't be an official hero because of his classified work, and kind of becomes a symbol of really bad things that happen when that's what you get for being gay, apparently, according to the British government. Mm-hmm. Thanks for nothing.
Very much a shame on us kind of movie.
Very much.
And
but
not
all of us.
But if you would have said that you have a film where Benedict is breaking code, which is and you know, this guy and Keira Knightley's in it as well, and there's, you know, the early incarnations of computers and notebooks and trying to figure, and you know, electronic gear, and if it were Monty Python, the machine that goes ping. Yeah. Would be involved with this, but it's really riveting. It's really exciting to watch.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. It's probably, I have not compiled my top 10 list, but it will probably be top 5. And for me, this felt like to me the moment where I really recognized Benedict Cumberbatch. I never seen Sherlock. I've only seen him in Star Trek Into Darkness that I know
and
of.
And he owes us 2 more good movies to make up for that movie.
Right.
Con.
But to me, this is where I saw this and I thought, okay, I get what this is all about with him.
Where he is kind of isolated, also isolated, focused. This is the only thing he can do, and he's a puzzle solver as opposed to a scientist, I guess, or a mathematician. That's how he kind of gets his motley crew, properly spelled, of people, including Keira Knightley, and it's a big deal because it's the 40s and she's a woman.
Right.
You know how when I walked out of the theater, you know what I was thinking about this movie.
Mm.
Wow, so this is how Sheldon and Penny became friends.
You know,
I
actually kind of compared it in my head to A Beautiful Mind, which is
only more accurate.
Yeah, and that's exactly the thought was, you know, and I think I mentioned this in our meeting or something, that this is what A Beautiful Mind maybe should have been. It's not afraid to show the quote unquote the warts of a great person, the things that polite society, especially at the time, would have frowned upon, and it made a more complete picture of him than we ever got of John Nash, you know, with Russell Crowe's performance aside. It really, really was just a terrific look at somebody, and by looking at one person, it gave us a reflection of us, like I hinted at the beginning, his treatment afterwards. You think about this, this man essentially invented the computer. This man invented the thing that every single one of us use multiple times a day. You know, if anything were said that computers run our lives nowadays, this man invented them, and he got no credit.
And eventually he got castrated by the British government.
Right, his efforts.
Almost literally chemically castrated,
Yeah, for his efforts, chemically castrated because of who he liked.
And there were moments, the film does go back and forth between the 40s, mm-hmm. the investigation to his house in the early 50s, and then when he's in school as a young boy, and the friendship that he had with a fellow classmates, and it's easy to follow. I know some folks get worried about nonlinear of going back and forth. This one is easy to follow. It's fine, mm-hmm. But yeah, Cumberbatch is really good in this,
and it's very subtle in bringing out that the political, quote unquote, political element of him being gay. They're really subtle about it early on. They really don't even address it until halfway through the movie or so, and then still it's still almost an undercurrent until you see kind of toward the end. You really see why it's such an important thing. And it makes a big difference in the movie to me.
So go see this, yeah. and think of that next time you get to your computer,
yeah.
People. Also opening this week, Disney's PG version of Into the Woods. As this is the one, because I know this from the community I get to hang out with. The theater community had their knickers wadded up and raring to go. I mean, I hadn't seen this much wadding since Les Mis, and none of it was toward Annie. That kind of got pushed by the wayside, which we agreed was kind of a nice surprise. Mm-hmm. But it's Sondheim's musical about all these familiar characters that we know, and the first half seems kind of familiar with songs, and then Act Two, which becomes darker, and what happens after Happily Ever After. Mm-hmm. I say it's a PG musical by Disney. I wish it had been PG-13. I wish it had been a little darker. Meryl Streep, Chris Pine, Anna Kendrick, Johnny Depp is in this briefly. Who else am I missing? Tracy Ullman and
Blunt,
James Corden, Emily Blunt, yes. And, you know, everybody in it is pretty good. I mean, as far as singing-wise, especially Streep.
I thought Streep was great. Oh, I mean, I thought every time she walked into a scene, everything changed. The
agreed.
Whole movie changed.
And this is not her first time singing, but it's the first time that she got to rap. I mean, just take something by both hands.
Yeah.
We know she sang in Mamma Mia. That's ABBA. It's not that. And that's just a jukebox musical. And I know she sang in Postcards from the Edge, which was over 20 years ago. But she just took this and made it her own. And this is saying a lot because Bernadette Peters kind of owns the stage version of this particular character. Yeah. But it just proves once again. I think she has a six in her age, and she's still creating fascinating work, no matter what is thrown her way.
I wasn't a big fan of the movie.
I wanted it to hit me more.
Yeah. I kind of felt like, and I told this to a couple people after the screening was over, that I felt like the movie was over, and you know the story was resolved. You know, the thing we had been going for was done, and I was ready to get up and leave. And I enjoyed it, and then the movie just kept going on.
Oh, no, that's the thing. I think that's the one problem. I think Disney really dropped the ball on the ad mm-hmm. campaign. I know they're trying to push it as a family musical, mm-hmm. but if you're not looking up Stephen Sondheim, I can't help you. and it's not that. Uh-huh. And the whole point is Act Two, and yep. it does go down a darker path. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do Act Two, I mean, if you wanted to make a movie of Act One, mm-hmm. fine, do that, but that's not what this is.
Right, right.
And, I mean, I already had people online asking me, should I take my kids? And of course, I'm like, well, how's your kid? I think usually I ask them when somebody asks me, you know, should I take my kids to go see this? I always ask the question, what's the darkest film your kid has experienced already?
Yeah.
And if it doesn't come close, I'm like, no, don't do that.
I had all three of mine.
Oh, boy, how'd that go?
It didn't bother them in the least. I think they just kind of gloss through the later parts of it, and I think they remember the early parts of the movie.
But I think the mall crowd and the non-theater crowd they're going to feel the same way. Yeah. They're going to think the film's going to drag on. I'm like, no, that's just kind of Act mm-hmm. Two. So, yeah. Ed, your thoughts on the picture?
I really enjoyed Meryl Streep. The rest of it I endured.
Mm-hmm. I really thought Chris Pine owned the movie for the time he was in it.
He had some good moments.
Yeah.
I didn't know he could sing, which is a nice touch.
Yeah.
I think that adds to your stock a little bit in this business.
Yeah.
He plays, of course, Prince Charming, uh-huh. and there's a duet between he and another guy, Prince.
Actually credited as Rapunzel's Prince.
I'm sorry, Rapunzel's Prince of Agony. And what I liked about it is, I think all the actors who sing and singers, it is used to their to the best of their abilities. And what I mean by that is, I've seen productions where the song Agony, the last note is a home run out of the park, and these guys didn't do that. And my question was, could they or couldn't they? Or either way, I mean, it is this kind of chest thumping parody of the human chin that is the fairy tale prince, and Pine gets to have a good time with that.
Yeah.
I really like Blunt. Uh-huh. I think she's another one where this just adds to her stock of she can do this, she can do that. Mm-hmm. It looks fun. It looks cool because it is. I don't know where they filmed this, although I think 90% of it was on a set.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to look that way because it's a storybook tale. Right. But yeah, my only issue is Act Two being not dark enough. But they didn't make this movie for me or for us.
I did feel like, and I noted this in my review, that I felt like, and I don't know how old the actual source material is. To me,
It's from the 80s.
It's from the 80s. Okay, so it did predate Shrek and all of those, which, you know, have done the same things, you know, theatrically. And that was what I thought was the movie plays as if it is very clever and innovative, and it's something that we've seen theatrically for years and years. The stage production then would probably best Shrek, and it probably is that sort
if it weren't for that. So it's like The Giver. You know, all the dystopian stuff came out. The films of those came out before The Giver, and we owe The Giver a bit of thanks for that, even though it wasn't that particularly exciting.
Yeah.
So there. That's also open. Finally, now, I always say when it's a day like Christmas or 4th of July, you know, or you know, where there's like 7 or 8 films that all open and they're all gunning for your hard-earned dollars. Not us, we're the press, we get in free. Mm-hmm. But but there's usually one film that kind of gets left out of it, you know, that nobody goes see. I always remember when Terminator 2 opened and the film that went up against it was Mel Brooks' Life Stinks.
Oh.
And it was just not fair. It's just you know, nobody's seeing that. And for a while, I thought the new Angelina Jolie directed film Unbroken was going to be that winner, but apparently James, you know, The Interview won that by default because it's in limited release.
Yeah.
But this is based on a true story of a gentleman who was an Olympic runner and then it becomes a prisoner of war in World War II Japan and then comes back. Basically. Yeah. But this film screams very, very important.
Yeah. And that's your description is about as exciting as the movie ever gets.
And I've heard from more than one person who have read the book, and it just and again, I haven't said this in months. It's film sociology, not book sociology.
Right.
But apparently the film just scratches the surface of what this guy went through.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who was somebody had was I can't remember who was somebody in our group that called it if you put Chariots of Fire, Life of Pi, and Bridge on the River Kwai in a blender.
Yes, yeah. There were a couple of us that contributed to that.
No, did that you were a part of that?
I was
snark.
Part of it. I think I introduced the Bridge on the River Kwai, the most obvious.
And, I of course, tried to be the historian and go, take out Life of Pi and put in Lifeboat.
Yeah. And it's any movie where someone is stranded by themselves on the ocean. And that's what the movie feels like. You know, I said at one point of our discussion of this movie that, for me, if you're in the water and there's a shark in the water with you, I am terrified, you know, as a viewer. That's a visceral reaction for me, almost involuntary. In this movie, that happens. Someone falls in the water. Of course, now there's something else going on. There is, you know, gunfire coming at them at the same time. But I have never been so apathetic about seeing someone in the water with a shark as I was with that movie. And that's how, to me, this whole movie goes. Is just, I want to be completely engaged in this movie. As you said, it sounds like one of the best stories of one of the best people who've ever lived. And I was completely bored. There was all of this stuff was happening that was supposed to be exciting. I mean, there are airplane fights, and there's an airplane crashing into the ocean, and there are men on the ocean with sharks.
And running.
And the Japanese are shooting at them from the air, and they get, you know, they're in a prisoner of war camp with the stereotypical guard who, you know.
Chris Lloyd's favorite boy. Don't bring that up around Chris.
So what did they do wrong, you guys?
I think it was just, I don't know, I don't want to just throw it on Angelina Jolie as the person who directed the movie, but I think it's on her. I think she didn't give it any kind of real visual style that was interesting. The characters didn't act in a particularly interesting way we're supposed to care about them just because of who they are, mm-hmm. but we don't really get any reason to care about them. They just seem like three or four faceless guys that are standing there that, okay, these are the people we're following. And, you know, she breaks off from war footage, or, you know, basically, this, you know, these people are going to war, and there's a whole sequence with a, you know, they've dropped a bomb and the bomb bay doors won't shut, and they're out standing over, you know, the abyss and trying to fix these doors. And I'm just like, okay, well, come on, get the door shut. No sense of urgency, no sense of danger. And then they break away for 20 minutes to a flashback of, you know, him in high school or college or something running, and then he's preparing for the Olympics. And then, oh, yeah, now we're going to come back to World War II.
Although I think when you mentioned the shark scene, I thought you quoted Warren Zevon when he was stuck in the water and his hair was perfect. I guess because we know you can't film, you know, we know you can't recreate the true horrors of war. We understand it. It's movies. We got that. If you want to make a documentary, make a documentary. But if you have the source material and you just kind of give us World War II 101, I would like to have seen it gone a little more. I would a little further, a little darker.
Yeah.
But I think she wanted to make was probably an inspirational story.
Yeah.
But it almost felt like it was our vegetables.
Yeah, it was sappy and maudlin. And
Ed, what did you think?
I didn't see it.
Oh, I thought you did. Okay, because
my DVD wouldn't play.
Oh, that was yours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, a little inside info. We get screeners in the mail for the award season, which we appreciate.
Absolutely.
Throughout the year, we normally see films in the theaters, except maybe for the occasional foreign film.
Right. The occasional foreign or art film that gets sent our way. But so when it gets to be November, December, we get a glut of which we really appreciate.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But every now and then, we will get one that just doesn't play, and I'm sure the studios are burning, because they can, you can't. They're burning copies of these to send out to various members of the media across the country. I get that. My winner this year was The Theory of Everything. Mine didn't work in my player, didn't work in my computer. And then we get these mass emails that we have, group emails to each other. Does anybody have a copy of this that I could borrow?
Yeah.
And three people, okay, we can do that. I'm going to be at the next screening on Tuesday. Bring it there. Okay, great. And I'll do that. And then so-and-so needs to borrow it because his doesn't work. I'll give it to you on Thursday. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so sorry that was your one didn't work picture.
Yeah,
so.
Mine was Citizen Four, the documentary Citizen
Four. Oh, really?
Yeah.
I finally watched that last week.
I think the government was conspiring against me seeing it. Yeah.
You personally?
Me personally.
Not me.
Maybe not.
Not
you.
Ed.
Yeah.
Oh, but I just want to throw this in.
Sure.
If you go online and you hear anyone talking about how the interview, everything that happened connected with the interview is a giant conspiracy to a publicity stunt, it isn't.
No.
Really, truly, the movie made about $1 million so far. I mean, it's maybe $2 or $3 million this weekend in theaters. It's going to make a pretty good amount of money on pay-per-view. Nothing like it would have made if they just dumped it in the normal release.
This isn't
a conspiracy.
Yep.
And one hint is the president of the United States doesn't participate in conspiracies for any movies, let alone movies where people hide things up bodily orifices.
Yep.
I don't know. This president, he just...
Well, he does do a lot of bad things.
Stop sounding like you're
everything
on Fox.
Everything is his fault.
But the other thing is... Also, if you need a piece of evidence to know that this is not a conspiracy, read the emails.
Yeah.
No executive in their life wants that out there.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm waiting for somebody to put on a theatrical production where they read the emails.
Yeah.
If that hasn't happened already, I'm sure that could be a Funny or Die thing.
Jimmy Kimmel could do the mean tweet.
Yeah, exactly. And I read some of these. It's really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember it was like a week after the hacking thing happened. There's Angelina Jolie staring at a face-to-face with one of the heads of Sony at an event, you know, the same woman that said, I don't want to make a Cleopatra movie with her because she's, a prima donna child.
Yeah.
Nobody wants these comments out there.
Yeah, it wasn't a concern. I mean,
no, it wasn't.
Not to mention that you think the high end for this movie is $150, $200 million if it was a runaway hit.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a flop, it's still bringing in 70 million theatrically, right? 50, 60, 70 million theatrically. It's going to make, like you said, 2 or 3 million theatrically.
Yeah.
even if it makes 20%, 30% more on home video, that's not even close to that. So, you know, that's there's no way. There's no way they would do this for a movie because
why would
it costs
you conspire
them money.
To,
right.
Just to lose, you're just throwing money away.
Yep. And it, I mean, it really does take a lot of effort to lose money between theater, home video, pay-per-view, global, you know, all that. So, I mean, you have to really apply yourself to make it stink bomb.
Yeah.
Also opening today, which we didn't see, The Gambler, which Mark Wahlberg remaking a James Caan film from the 70s.
When I think James Caan, you know, who would I want? Mark Wahlberg is the guy.
Wait, this isn't a remake of the Kenny Rogers movie?
No, it's not the Kenny Rogers movie, although I just saw Kenny in a commercial. His plastic surgery is kicking and settling in, which
is
nice.
Do you remember how Mark Wahlberg was a joke, then he became really something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does it seem like he's inching his way back to being a joke?
Oh, I don't know.
It depends on how this movie goes.
Well,
what makes you think this, Ed?
It just seems like he's doing more and more films where not much is called for from him other than, you know, I mean, Transformers, for God's sake.
Oh, gosh.
Why?
Because they threw a ridiculous amount of money at him on that one.
Because he's got kids.
I would say, because I have not seen Transformers. You did. It made your annoying five, and we appreciate you seeing that because we didn't have to. what was worse for Wahlberg, Transformers or The Happening?
Oh, The Happening was worse.
Did it look like he was giving more of an effort in the Michael Bay film than The Happening?
No.
Okay.
I mean, he was on all, you know, you're playing an action figure, and he got that down right.
Yeah, he can do that. He's done that, so.
Yeah. Transformers was.
So maybe this is the one where, you know, he got the, you know, sometimes Clooney and many people have talked about it, where you do one for the studio and you do one for yourself. Mm-hmm. So he got a, you know, the kids' college payments are fine for Transformers, and he does a remake of a 70s James Caan film. Yeah, you're right, Ed. I don't think of Mark Wahlberg when I think of James Caan.
No.
So he's going to eventually grow up and be Will Ferrell's dad. No, he isn't. But it does make me want to watch this. I remember this because it was James Caan and Lauren Hutton, and it was James Toback, one of his early films. And this, I believe, was directed or written by the guy who wrote The Departed. So there is that. And then a film opening. Oh, it opens January 2nd. Sometimes you have to read, but opening in theaters January 2nd.
Sometimes you do have to
sometimes
read.
Sometimes you do. Ask Tyler Hansborough. Or read all the way. The Woman in Black, Angel of Death, which is a sequel to a 2012 thriller starring Daniel Radcliffe.
This
does not have Daniel Radcliffe. He was too busy being in porn. Horns. Not porns.
No.
That's a different movie. But another haunted house movie. I think this one is an orphanage that's in bad situations.
Yeah.
So that's it. So there's plenty out there, and there's still plenty of really good films out there, like Whiplash, and
Whiplash.
Please go see Whiplash.
Yes, go. This is part of the campaign. Go see Whiplash. Yeah. If anything else,
yeah.
So I guess, Ed, if you don't mind me asking, what has changed from your top 10, if you can recall?
Well, Three Cops has gone up to number one.
For the most annoying?
No. It's just, I mean, it's a laugh riot. It teaches you things that are important. It's just a spec film all around. And I'm just being silly.
Is
here.
The film dragging or rushing?
No, I just the stuff on my list is moved around. Whiplash is ahead. I go back and forth in Boyhood and Whiplash.
Yeah,
boy, that's a tough decision to have. That's kind of a nice tough decision.
It's a yin and yang thing almost, you know.
I think you guys were talking about how, you know, one is.
This is courtesy of Sam Watermeyer, Film Yap writer. And the
things, a little of this, a little of that.
Quite a lot going on right now. Thanks
for asking. Yeah. And one of those people who make that quite a lot going on happen. He also the newest member of the Indiana Film Journalists Association as of January 1st.
Oh, hazing, ladies and gentlemen. Right. That did not happen.
Yeah.
Listening to us is hazing enough.
Yeah, he made a thematic comparison between the two of them. I think it's a very scholarly kind of comparison to make, that, you know, one is they're both coming of age stories, and they're both centered around a father figure who is in and out of someone's life, but then the Whiplash, of course, is much more adversarial than Boyhood. Yeah, both of them are true. They're probably 1, 2 for me as well. Maybe Boyhood is a 3, but those are two just really good movies.
That's a nice dilemma to have.
Yeah, yeah.
So
on the way over, just before I left, we left to come over here, I had the TV on and I saw an ad that it said, "The Flash coming in January to Channel 8. And it was like, oh, good God. Uh-huh. It's real. It's happening.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Channel 8 mm-hmm. is going to be showing the CW.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
It's just, you know,
this is unimaginable to me. As someone
it
who,
is.
Yeah. That this is, to me, that, you know, as someone who was in and out of the Indianapolis market my whole life, my whole childhood, television was something that, you know, I always came back and looked forward to seeing Mike Ahern and Debbie Knox.
Yes.
You know, on TV. And I would come back and see them, you know, and you know all the CBS shows are going to be on Channel 8. And then that absolutely floored me that they're switching. And yeah, and it's surreal to me.
The reason I brought it up in this context was this. Well, part of it, I'm a doddering old man. But aside from that.
I'm sorry, sir. Mr. Doddering Old Man?
That's right.
Yes, right.
A young whippersnapper. But the reason I brought it up was annually we turn on Channel 4 on Halloween and we watch Sammy Terry, who was a guest on with
Matt. He's one of our regulars.
What's going to happen this Halloween? Because Channel 4 is going to be running Letterman and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, whatever they run.
We put out a call to Sammy. Sammy doesn't have people. He actually answers the phone directly mm-hmm. himself and goes through the phone booth vapor.
It's not that he doesn't have them. They're just afraid.
Correct. Yes.
Somebody in this town has got to make sure that Sammy Terry is on TV Saturday night or Halloween night.
Absolutely. If not more.
Yeah, I was going to say, some of us would love to see that come back as a regular.
Every week.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be great.
So fun.
Channel 8's got the room. Yeah.
They do. Not the room.
Not the room. No, no.
No, what's that?
Well, their CW programming is over by 10.
Right. Yeah. So
they wouldn't even have to preempt anything.
So, ladies and gentlemen, please, please, please start flooding their
that's
with
right.
telegrams.
Yeah.
No, telegrams. Do old school telegrams. Yes. Have the guys in the little brown suits mm-hmm. come over. Not those brown suits. Mm-hmm. And just knee deep in telegrams. It sounds like network. Mm-hmm. And just tell them, we want Sammy Terry on every week. If Svengoolie can be on every week on MeTV, Saturday nights at 10, then Sammy Terry should be on to represent Indianapolis.
And if you see anybody from Channel 8 that you know, anybody. Be sure to tell them, because you know they're feeling kind of down right now.
Yep.
Be sure to tell them that public radio was talking about them and saying that Sammy Terry needs to be on their program list because God knows it's pitiful and it needs something to read. You know.
We're going to tell my colleague Christopher Lloyd at the Film Me Up, who is a Channel 8 not employee, but he's
there.
He's there on mm-hmm. a regular basis. And we'll tell him that Wish TV is too scared to show Sammy. Ooh.
They're yellow. They're yellow.
Film sociology has spoken.
Boy, this is like sports team taunting.
Sammy Terry, Channel 8. That's what's going to happen.
There you go. Cobe, do you have things going on at your alma mater over there?
Well, yeah, in a couple weeks. We're 2 weeks away from the return of IU Cinema. But before that, next week, Friday, January 2nd, starts the Winter Night Series at the IMA.
Yes. Remind us.
Yes, January 2nd, the IMA is showing Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Come early for a bluegrass performance.
Very nice.
Are you going to be a part of the Foggy Mountain Boys? Will you have a fake beard on while you're jumping around?
Soggy Bottom.
Ooh. Yeah.
Now, will the new $150 admission charge cover the movie, too? Or is that extra?
Moving on.
Don't worry about that.
Sorry.
So January 2nd, we got Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? January 9th is the Wizard of Oz. And before that, they're going to show you some synced up parts to Dark Side of the Moon. Which
and they're
going to
drop a house on
awesome.
A witch. No, and Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth will not be there.
January 16th, Spirited Away.
Emma's
come early
there.
Join the drawing club. January 23rd, this will be cool. They're going to show Fargo outdoors.
I'm still on the fence on that one because, I mean, right now it's fine weather-wise, but I love Fargo, and I understand what they're trying to do. Yeah. I don't want to freeze while I'm enjoying myself.
Yeah. I don't want hypothermia.
Well, they'll probably rent you blankets for $40.
Moving on.
So that takes us through. Actually, no. Then we have January 30th, Hard Day's Night. February 6th, Bringing a Baby. February 13th.
Well, they'll bring in a leopard to run around the theater.
February 13th, An Affair to Remember. February 20th.
They'll sink a ship.
Peter Pan from 1924.
They'll have a 50-year-old woman dressed as a 13-year-old boy.
They'll throw somebody off the roof of the building.
February 27th.
Chris Walken will show up and not care. And they'll have a killer bunny.
At Monty Python, they're dismembering someone.
And coconuts.
So that's going every Friday night at the IMA starting next week through the end of February. So even though January is dismal and horrible around here, there is something to do on Friday
and
nights.
And tourable.
If you're rich.
And tourable.
Yeah, because when we start getting into the now, to be fair, there will be a trickling of award contending films, but there's also going to be the smattering of Let's Be Cops like material. Mm-hmm. So if you need a break from the multiplexes, you can go to the IMA. Yeah. And
if you're rich,
but then
Ed
also,
Johnsonat, Nouveau News Weekly, feel free to contact me. I will gladly talk with you about it for as long as you care to talk.
317-555-4214.
N-U-V-O.
But then the following week, yes. January 7th at IU Cinema from 1986, they're going to show Hoosiers and have David Anspaugh and Angelo Pizzo.
Oh, very film nice. Sociology guest, Angelo Pizzo.
Friend of the film, yeah.
Very good.
Well, kind of.
Is this like a Pam Grier fight?
Yeah.
I first. Shut up. Okay, moving on. I guess we have dead people we like because we don't have Ted time for dead people we don't like. Right. Bernalisi passed away, who I know from a couple, she starred in a couple of really kind of forgettable 1960s romantic comedies. How to Murder Your Wife with Jack Lemmon, and Not With My Wife You Don't, which I believe was Tony Curtis and George C. Scott. Oh. And went a little bit back and forth between Hollywood and her homeland, and later starred Queen Margot in 1994. She's from Italy, of course. I love this because thanks to Mystery Science Theater, Booth Coleman, who died, he was a guy who was a regular on, World Without End, which was part of a Mystery Science Theater picture, and this was his obit picture, which is great for radio.
Yeah. And did you say Vera started in How to Murder Your Wife?
Pardon?
You said one of the people starred in How to Murder Your Wife.
Right, the Jack Lemmon comedy.
Did she also star in How Your Art Museum Can Alienate the Community?
And Murder Your Wife.
I think Simon Pegg made good. That movie.
And then director Joseph Sargent, who passed away, who did a lot of TV in the 60s, but did some pretty good 70s, 80s fare. Like the first thing of note out of television was a film called The Man, which I believe Alex Haley did the screenplay, and it was James Earl Jones who becomes the first Black president in 1972. He plays who's third in command? It's a president, vice president,
speaker of the house.
He's the speaker of the house. Yeah. So this is hard hitting stuff for the 70s. Yeah. The 1973 Burt Reynolds action movie White Lightning,
ooh,
the first film with Gator McCluskey, good stunt work. Mm-hmm. Ned Beatty is a nasty sheriff.
Hal Needham.
Hal Needham was a stunt coordinator on that one. Mm-hmm. The original from 1974, and Quentin Tarantino is thankful for it, the original The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, mm-hmm, which had, there was a period where Walter Matthau was considered an action star.
If they do a reboot of that now, it'll be called The Taking of Pelham Volume 1.
There you go.
And then Volume
No, 20. Actually Volume 4, and then they would do that. So he also did the biopic MacArthur starring Gregory Peck. He also got Susan Anton a sing role in the film Golden Girl. Coast to Coast, because you need more Robert Blake and Diane Cannon from 1980. Jaws the Revenge.
Oh, yeah.
So, you have seen his work.
That's where I know him.
Yeah. That's the one where the dead shark goes on a vendetta.
Yes,
that's right.
From
travels to the Bahamas.
Yes, from
down
England
there.
To the Bahamas because it knows that this lady's going to get on the plane.
And then a couple of...
he's mad because her husband killed him.
And it roars.
And as Michael Caine said, I've never seen the movie, but I've seen the view from the house that movie got me.
There you
so
go.
Thank
it's
you for that. And in a couple of noted HBO films, because there was that period where HBO was making movies that were slightly better than the blockbusters, there was it was Warm Springs with Kenneth Branagh as FDR, and Something the Lord Made with Mos Def, he's still called Mos Def then, and Alan Rickman. Do we have words to live by?
Yep.
Great.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
And somebody get Ed Johnsonat a Zardoz belt buckle.
I just want to see the movie.
And we should come back next week.
Yeah.
You guys do anything next Friday?
No.
I don't
we'll have to do the year in review, see if our top and worst have changed.
Okay.
Unless somebody wants to give me a job.
There you go. Yeah, go see a good movie. You deserve it. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Yeah, all that. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org.
We gone. Good night, Fort Myers. Good night, California.